Father, we thank you for all the ways that you provide for us and bless us and sustain us, carry us along. We thank you for your word that you have preserved for us so that we can know you, know your plans. And ultimately, everything that has been written is to give us hope. And so we pray that you'll give us wisdom and insight into the things we're going to read together today so that we can know you better and love you more deeply. And we ask all this for Jesus' great name's sake. Amen. All right, y'all. Last week we left off five verses into chapter 22 of 1 Samuel. And in your notes, we're on page 37 down at the bottom. This section, this whole section that began in chapter 21, this is where David is on the run. A lot of people call this his wilderness flight or his wilderness wanderings. If you're Baptist, you want to go wilderness wanderings, right? Because that's a lot better to have two W's. Good in a sermon. So David is on the run from Saul, and Saul is pursuing David relentlessly. David flees down to the south into the wilderness area of Judah. And last week we left off, let me say this. Last week, David had first fled to Nob, which is one of the cities that the priest would gather in. And he had gone there and he had eaten some of the bread of the presence. Y'all remember that? The very thing that Jesus refers to in Matthew. And as he's there, he also gets Goliath's sword to take with him. But there's an Edomite there in Nob named Doeg, and he's going to go back and report to Saul. We're going to hear from him today. David flees from Nob down to Gath, and the king of Gath finds out that David is, and so he acts like a crazy person. Remember that? And then in chapter 22, he flees over back into the further into the wilderness to the cave of Adullam. And that's where we've left David. He is there, and he knows that Saul is pursuing him. But Saul, he goes to Nob, and things are not going to go well. So let's read a little bit of this. Chapter 22, verse 6. And again, we're going to do some big picture summary today, but I want to read this first part because it really sets us up for what's going to happen in these next couple of chapters. Verse 6, it says, "Now Saul heard that David was discovered and the men who were with him. And Saul was sitting at Gibeah under the tamarisk tree on the height with a spear in his hand, and all of his servants were standing about him. And Saul said to his servants who stood about him, 'Hear now, people of Benjamin, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds? That all of you have conspired against me?'" Right, so here Saul's starting to realize it seems like everybody's turned against me. Right, David's fled down here. Y'all didn't say anything about it. Is David going to treat y'all as good as I've treated you? And what's the answer to that going to be? Nice. He's going to treat him better. Right? So Saul doesn't have a real good track record, the little snippets that we've seen. He goes on, middle of verse 8, "Does no one discloses to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse?" Right, he's already been mad at Jonathan. He tried to kill Jonathan chapter before last. And now he's mad at everybody else because they haven't told him that Jonathan's actually made a covenant with David, but he's found out about it. And he says, "None of you discloses that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as at this day." Now, that's really important, because what Saul thinks is everybody's conspired against him so that they can come together and maybe kill him, right? That seems to be what he has in his head. Then, verse 9, "Then answered Doeg the Edomite, who stood by the servants of Saul, 'I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him provisions and gave him the sword of Goliath the Philistine.' And so the king sent to summon Ahimelech, the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's house, and the priests who were at Nob. And all of them came to the king, verse 12. And Saul said, "Hear now, son of Ahitub." And he answered, "Here I am, my lord." And Saul said to him, "Why have you conspired against me, you and the son of Jesse, in that..." Notice how Saul refers to David by everything except his name. And he's going to change that in just a little bit. But he always refers to him as the son of Jesse, something like that, or either where he's from. Here he's just the son of Jesse. He didn't even call him by name. And I think that's intentional because, again, in Hebrew, if he calls David by his name, he's literally saying out loud, right, "Why have you conspired against me, against the beloved?" Right? So that'll call up all kind of images. So he calls him the son of Jesse. Right? Now, in that day, you have given him bread and a sword and have inquired of God for him so that he has arisen against me to lie in wait to this day. Now see that again? David's done all that so that he can get me. So he can hide out, lie in wait. He's like a predator, right? Crouching, waiting to get Saul. 14, then Ahimelech, now this is really important. Then Ahimelech answered the king, "Now, who among your servants is so faithful as David? Who is the king's son-in-law, captain over your bodyguard, and honored in your house? Is today the first time that I've inquired of God for him? No, let not the king impute anything to his servant or to all the house of my father, for your servant has known nothing of all this, much or little." And so what Ahimelech's saying is, I don't know what you're talking about. This is your son-in-law. Yeah, hadn't he been faithful to everything that you've asked him to do? That's all I know. Verse 16, then the king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house." And the king said to the guard who stood about him, "Turn and kill the priest of the Lord." Look at what he calls him. "Turn and kill the priest of Yahweh, the Lord. Because their hand also is with David. And they knew that he fled and did not disclose it to me. But the servants of the king would not put out their hand to strike the priest of the Lord." And then the king said to Doeg, "You turn and strike the priest." And Doeg the Edomite turned and struck down the priest. And he killed on that day 85 persons who wore the linen ephod. So he kills 85 priests that day. 19, and Nob, the city of the priest, he put to the sword, both man and woman, child, infant, ox, donkey, sheep, he put to the sword. That's pretty drastic, right? So at the command of Saul, Doeg, this Edomite, he kills not only the priest, but the whole city. And so down at the bottom of page 37, I've got some notes about all that. Again, Saul accuses his leaders of conspiracy. Doeg reports upon David, right? Again, Saul is twisted in his thinking, right? Thinking that both Jonathan and David are conspiring together to kill him. Ahimelech, the priest, tries to reason with Saul. By the way, those numbers are wrong there. Bottom of page 37. That should be chapter 22, 11 through 6. Y'all see, I got excited and jumping ahead to chapter 23. But that should be 22, 11 through 6. And also the next heading, that should be 22, 17 through 19. This story is almost an inverse of what we had heard earlier, where Saul was tasked with going and destroying the Amalekites. You remember that? And instead, what did they do? They kept some of the best sheep and oxen and all that, right? And then Saul tried to spin it. Well, we did what the Lord told us to do. We just kept the best stuff for a sacrifice, right? And the Lord's commands to do that type of ultimate destruction, that's at the bottom of page 37. That was the command that we looked at, that when the Lord was given the people instruction when they were going to go in and take over the land after they had been in Egypt. And then they were going in under Joshua, right, 40 years after the wilderness wanderings. The Lord had instructed them that when you go into the cities of the land that I promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right, your forefathers, you are to destroy everything that has the breath of life in it, right? You're to completely obliterate it because of the idolatry, right, and the wickedness that was going on in there. And so what Doeg does here is exactly that. But instead of doing it to the people who it should be done to, the Canaanites and all the rest. He actually does it to the priest of the Lord and to a city, right, that's set apart for the service of the Lord and so forth. So this is a complete inversion of that. And so here, Saul refused to do that earlier with the Canaanites that the Lord had instructed him to do it to, but now he does it to his own people. Right? So this is his one of his final, and I can't even think of a good word, an unthinkable sin that Saul does there. Nobody in their right mind would do the kind of thing that Saul's doing there. He's just lost his mind at this point, right? He's gone crazy. I read several years ago, I got a good friend of mine introduced me to the work of a fellow named Dr. Jim Wilder. And Dr. Jim Wilder calls himself a neurotheologian. He went to seminary and got a degree in theology and so forth. And then he got out and started doing counseling. And he realized that there were people that everybody said, there's no help for these people whatsoever. And he said, well, wait a minute, I believe in Jesus. So it can't be people that there's no help for whatsoever, right? So that spurred him to go back in and get a degree in neuroscience. How does our brain work and all that kind of thing. And so he's written some really incredible works, but one of his books is called The Other Half of Church, and it's basically the case he's making is we've made everything very academic in the church so that we focused on what we know rather than emphasizing what our brains and our minds do naturally, and that is we are relational beings, right? And your mind, 6 times a second, it's constantly processing the world, and it's only trying to figure out one of two things. Are these my people, or are these my enemies? And that's what your brain is on high alert all the time trying to figure out, right? Because you think about it, that's really important to know. And that's all. And you know, I've told my girls from their youth up, you have to trust your gut, right? If something does not feel right, it is not right. Because your body is a spiritual antenna that can pick up on things that you may not be able to process, right, with thoughts. But if something doesn't feel right, it is not right. You get out of there immediately, right? Well, he talks about that in the book, and he says, yeah, that's what our bodies do. That's where our minds work. If something doesn't feel, I'm like, thank you. Somebody finally showed the girl. See, now I wasn't making that up. This guy right here. But one of the things that he talked about in the book, I found this so interesting. He talked about that in churches, one of the things that we often have to deal with are narcissists, right? Now, immediately, there's probably things pop in your mind about what a narcissist is. But the way he defined what the core of narcissism is blew my mind. I had to read it over and over and think about it. But this is what he says a narcissist is. He says a narcissist is somebody who cannot catalyze shame back into positive emotions and back to a positive response in the world, right? Somebody who cannot catalyze shame back into things positive. Y'all are probably thinking, where is he going with this, right? So then what a narcissist does is they can't deal with their own negative feelings and emotions. So what do? They try to manipulate others. They try to spin the story into something else. They try to gaslight you, right? Into being on their side of things, even if it's not actually true, right? And as I've been reading through the Saul story, right, he's a textbook example of this, right? This whole thing starts when he gets jealous of David, right? He's shamed by David's fame. And he can't catalyze that back into something positive. He turns it into the negative. And so what does he do? He tries to spin the story. He tries to connive, catch David in a trap. He tries to kill him, right? He tries to manipulate things. And here, this is the ultimate expression of all that, right? Saul thinks that he is such the center of the whole universe that no matter what he does, he's not going to get in trouble over it. He can even kill the priesthood. He can even slaughter people in one of the Israeli cities and have no thought to it whatsoever. Right? And so as I've been reading through this story, to me, it's just amazing. Number one, how we're reading this narrative that's 3,000 years old. And the reality is nothing's really changed about humanity, right? This stuff could be on the, and it is on the front page of our papers today, right? Jealousy, envy, hatred, right? All these things that lead to all these negative, murder, hatred, all these kind of things that pop up. And so here, this is kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back, for the lack of a better word. This is one of Saul's final great paramount sins that explains what happens to him in these latter chapters as we go forward. So, devastating chapter, just terrible. David continues to flee. There at the end of chapter 22, Abiathar, one of the priests, he escapes and he comes down and he's going to hang out with David from that point forward. He says, listen, Saul, who's seeking your life, he seeks my life too. Let me put my lot in with you. And David says, yeah, great. Y'all come on, hang out. We got all these people that are on the run. We'll definitely take you in. So yeah, devastating chapter. Very, very powerful. And we'll see how some threads that connect to these next couple of chapters that we've set up right there in that chapter. Anybody questions or comments about any of that before we move on from there? Yeah.
Any idea of the count of these guys compared to the total count of the priesthood? Is this a significant amount of priests for the country?
It would have been a significant number. Yeah, I'm not sure how many they would have had at this time, but it would have been a chunk. Yeah, 80 something. That would have been good. By the time you get to Jesus in the first century, after they had built the temple, there were literally thousands of priests. You know, so if we kind of extrapolate out of that back to this time, I would guess that there's probably not more than, you know, somewhere in the hundreds of priests at this time. But it would have been, yeah, it would have been a significant number. And a lot of them, of course, we don't have, you know, capital city as such. You know, now Jerusalem, I mean, later Jerusalem will come on the scene and everything will be centralized there. So these priests were serving, you know, all throughout the nation at that point. And so there were certain cities where they would be collected together that people would go to, you know. And so, yeah, this would have been significant. It would have been a lot. Yeah, yeah.
Just do what Saul said.
Yeah.
He said, hey, there's more over there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's weird.
Well, and he is he's an Edomite, right?
Esau's,
yeah. So they haven't had a great relationship. And earlier, when we saw him at Nob, the way he was described, it seems like that he had been sent there as some type of punishment to serve there, because there's no other reason for him to be there. So he's probably been out of shape about everything. You know, this sounds terrible, but this is why in ancient warfare you didn't want to leave many of your enemies alive, right? There was no such thing as taking prisoners of war during this time. If you won the battle, you killed every one of the opposing soldiers because you don't want him coming back. When a new, and this will be relevant for what we're about to see, when a new king comes in, it was the best thinking that you should kill all the members of the family of the king that had just been there before you, because you don't want to have one of those little jack wagons coming up and threatening you, right? Opposing you as king. Hey, you know, my dad was king first, maybe. And that's one of the things that both Jonathan has already pled with David about, hey, when you come to power, please don't cut my whole line off. Remember me. Saul's going to do the same thing. In fact, just a second, Saul's going to do the same thing with David. Hey, when you become king, please don't wipe my line off the face of the earth. And David agrees to that. I mean, these are brutal times, right? Brutal times. People put as much thought and worry into killing another human being did as my great grandmother did wringing a chicken's neck. I mean, I'm not exact, right? I mean, we are so unused to seeing death. This is just normal stuff for them. What I would say is he allowed it, but it wasn't the best thing that he wants, you know? This is one of those really, difficult things. The Lord often allows so many things, but yet they're still displeasing to him on some level, you know, because in the scheme of things, he's got bigger fish to fry, you know, as he's moving things along and so forth.
What did he always tell the people when they went in and conquered somebody to kill them? And they wouldn't do it?
Yeah, there were several. Yeah, they got in trouble for it. And there were several. He also told them that y'all can make alliances with the nations that are on the outskirts of the land, right? But when you go into the land, you're not to make an alliance or a covenant. But they did that on a couple of times, where they let the people in the land trick them and make a covenant, and then that caused trouble for generations to come. You know, yeah. These are whole different culture, whole different times. You know, we are literally stepping into an alien world that's so far removed from anything that we're used to on any kind of level. Yes.
I think this is some great part that you gave us to study, because most people don't like the Old Testament.
I know, yeah, and it's a shame.
This
yeah.
is a great relationship between good and evil.
Yeah.
If you read First Psalms, it says about how to live a good life
yeah.
and a bad life.
That's right. This is it.
Story
That's right.
about Saul and how he lived when yeah. God chose him.
Yeah.
And Paul, I mean, and
David. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Right. It's good for especially young people.
Yeah.
And even old folks just like us.
Yeah.
Everybody should read this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I just can't wait for next.
Yeah.
He's such a good person to listen and read. You
know? He is in the beginning, but at the end he fails miserably.
Yeah.
Right? And that's to me that's the great overarching thing. You know, we romanticize these stories so much, you know, because we grew up with them in Sunday school, and you know, David, we put him up on the flannel graph or whatever it was, you know, now I don't know what they're doing nowadays. You know, and he's the good guy with the sling and the rocks, you know, but I never learned about Bathsheba and the murder and the treachery, you know, the total mismanagement of his household that brings about the split of the kingdom that comes. I mean, in just a minute, y'all listen, if y'all haven't read the end of 1 Samuel yet, David is a treacherous dude, right? He is, he's not a guy you want to mess with, you know? He is not a guy that we would hang out with probably unless we were a part of his band of scoundrels, you know? Now, I'm not taking anything away from all the good stuff that David does, because all throughout all that, he's continually faithful to the Lord, right? All right? He's continually faithful to the Lord. And everything that the Lord calls him to, when the Lord catches him in sin, he immediately, oh, Lord, I did it. I messed up, right? I sinned mightily before you, right? But he's not perfect. He, you know, and that's what I love about these stories. These are us. Right? These people are not heroes that we're supposed to, in a sense, emulate. These are people that we read and we think, they're just like us. They're frail human beings. You know? That's right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And even in the midst of your failure, the Lord still brings blessing. Right? So many times in some of our modern theology, we believe the old, I don't even know where it all comes from, right? If you do good, the Lord will bless you. If you do bad, the Lord will not bless you, right? The Bible disproves that on every page, right? On every page, it disproves that, right? People that go entirely against what the Lord does, he'll often bring blessing to them, right? And again, he's looking at the motives. A lot of times, the interior motives of what's going on. He can also see where things are headed, right? He can also understand, well, I'll let him do that, but I want to do this, that, or the other, and we'll get him to the place. So, man, these stories are they're so instructive, and as Sheila said, they illustrate these larger points of theology for us, you know, that we get in the Psalms, David, right? Psalm 103, right? As far as the east is from the west, so has the Lord removed our sinfulness from us, right? And the thing, the way he begins that, though, is, for he remembers that we are but dust, right? When the Lord looks at us, yet we've been created in his image, no doubt. We're incredible. We're glorious. But you got to remember, he made you out of dirt, too, right? So don't get too, we are high and elevated and the pinnacle of his creation, but he made us out of dirt, right? And those two things go hand in hand, right? It's always the two together. It's not one or the other. It's the both end. I've had to write so many emails and talk to so many people this year that are just going through tragic circumstances, you know? And every time we talk about it, I bring up the fact that the joy that we have in this life, it's always mixed with the sorrow.
Right.
And those three things go hand in hand.
You were going through a lot of that too with your family.
Yeah. There's a lot of it. You know, small wins, joys, but there's anxiety and worry. It won't be till the kingdom comes, right, that all the mourning and the tears and the crying is pulled away. And the Lord is preparing for that right here with David and Saul. You know, that's what blows my mind. Everything we're reading right now is ultimately taking us to Revelation 22, right? And that, to me, that's the incredible thing about it, you know? Wild, good stuff. But again, from a whole alien world from where we are. All right, y'all, in your notes, page 38, chapter 23, page 38 in your notes. We're in chapter 23. I'm just going to summarize some of this. Y'all can read this. There is not a lot that's difficult to see here, but in chapter 23, the first 14 verses, David flees down to a city named Keilah. You can see it on your map down at the bottom of page 33. David has been running around down in the wilderness, right? Saul has been up in Gibeah. If you can find that on your map, kind of in the up to the toward a little bit toward the top of the map, you have Jerusalem and Gibeah and Nob all together. Everybody see that? Right to the left of the Dead Sea, top of the Dead Sea there. So we've been in Nob. Saul's been in Gibeah. He's been pursuing David down south towards Keilah. You can see that in the middle of Judah down there. And so that's where David has fled to. And the Philistines have been fighting against Keilah. And so David inquires of the Lord, should I go down there and help Keilah, deliver Keilah? And the Lord says, yeah, go down, fight, and I'll give you victory over it. So David goes down and he fights, and they bring relief to the city of Keilah. But Saul finds out about it. And so David's warned about it, and he inquires again of the Lord. He says, listen, if I stay here, will the people of Keilah turn me over to Saul? And the Lord says, yes, they will. So David says, all right, we're going to move on then. Right? We're going to get on out of here. So David escapes from Keilah. And that's probably good because after he leaves, word goes back to Saul. And in verse 23:13, Saul turns away from pursuing David at Keilah. And by David fleeing from there, he more than likely spares that city. Because what had just happened at Nob, more than likely Saul would have gone down there and killed that city as well. So by David fleeing from the city, he probably spares it from Saul's wrath. Verse 15, I want to read a little bit of this. As David again flees from there and he's headed back out to the wilderness of Ziph, you can see that on your map as well. We're going to see several of these cities in the next couple of chapters. On your map, you can see there's an arrow pointing up to the area of the wilderness of Ziph. You have Horesh, Hebron, Engedi, Bethel, Beersheba down at the bottom of the map there in Simeon's territory. So for the next several chapters, we're going to be in that general area there to the west of the Dead Sea. David's going to be running around. Saul's going to be pursuing him. But Jonathan comes to him, verse 15, and again, David sees that Saul has come out after him, and so he's in Horesh. You can see where that is on your map. And verse 16, it says, and Jonathan, Saul's son, rose and went to David at Horesh and strengthened his hand in God. And he said to him, do not fear, for the hand of Saul, my father, shall not find you. Now look at verse 17. You shall be king over Israel, and I will be next to you. Saul, my father, also knows this. There it is. So at least by this point, and I think it's probably earlier, Saul knows that David has been picked to be the next king. And I think he's probably found that out earlier because that's what's driving him crazy, trying to pursue David based on what he says to Jonathan and what he's going to say from this point forward. So Jonathan makes a covenant again, verse 18, with David. The two of them made a covenant before the Lord. David remained at Horesh. Jonathan went home. Verse 18, you could also read that. The two of them had made a covenant before the Lord. Right? So it's a reminder of what they've done earlier. If you remember back in chapter 20, Jonathan and David had made a covenant together. And Jonathan asked David not to cut his family line off when he came to power. So here, that could be a recall to that. While David's there, verse 19, the Ziphites, they go up to Saul and say, hey, David's hiding down in Horesh. If you come down, you can probably catch him now. Look at verse 23-21. Saul said to them, may you be blessed by the Lord, for you have compassion on me. Saul gave him blessings for his murderous attempts, right? 22, go make yet more sure. Know and see the place where his foot is and who has seen him there, for it is told that he is very cunning. See that, end of verse 22? Very cunning. Does your translation have something different there? Crafty. Yeah, crafty or cunning. I've got a note about this on page 38. This is one of the word plays that goes all the way back to Genesis. Naked, crafty, cunning. The word for crafty or cunning in Hebrew sounds exactly like the word for naked. And the first time we see the word play is in Genesis 2:24 and in 3:1. In 2:24, that's where it says, now Adam and Eve were naked, and yet they were unashamed. And the very next verse, 3:1, says, now the serpent was more crafty, but it sounds just like naked. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's a word play going on there. And in fact, if you had heard Moses telling that around the campfires out in the wilderness, you probably would have heard the same word, that the serpent was more naked than all the other beasts of the field, right? In other words, they shared something with Adam and Eve and so forth. Here, though, the word play is most likely meant to expose, if you remember earlier when Saul was pursuing David and David had fled to Samuel, Saul showed up and he began to prophesy and he stripped naked and he was naked before Samuel all day and night. You remember that? So this is probably meant to be a play on that, whereas Saul was exposed in his nakedness, David is now hidden because of his craftiness, right? But yeah, there is definitely Saul taking a jibe at him, because again, if you've been reading from Genesis right through this history, then there you would pick up on that association that Saul seems to be implying that David is cunning just like the serpent was, right? You got to watch this guy. He'll lie, right? And what has he already said twice? Well, he's lying in wait for me. He's like a coiled up snake, just waiting. Come and pow, get me, right? At least that's the way Saul sees it. He says, now, verse 23, take note of all the lurking places where he hides. Right? So that sounds like what a snake does. Come back to me with sure information, then I'll go out. So they go out, they spy on David. David is running around. But as Saul is pursuing him, he gets word that the Philistines have attacked. And so he has to leave and go head back up north. And so David goes from there, and he moves over to En Gedi and stays there. Moves from Horesh across to En Gedi. Again, you can see that on your map. Bottom of page 38, where he's just moved, you know, just a short distance over to En Gedi. If you've ever been to Israel, you'll know that there in En Gedi, there's springs and there's a waterfall, and it's a nice place to go. Got built-in natural air conditioning over there. So, you know, if you're out fleeing and need a good place to hang low for a while, that's a good place to go. So he is there. And that's going to set us up for what's going to happen in these next two chapters, which, again, is probably some of the more famous parts of this story. Anybody questions or comments on any of that so far? Everybody tracking along okay? Yeah, Ann?
God weaves little details in that would they have done it, so had to be, and had issues with customs. I mean,
just move on back. Yeah. And you see the Lord working that way all the way through, just little tiny things where he'll move this, he'll do that, you know. It's so cool to see. And again, you know, it goes back to show what we had said earlier, where it stated explicitly that the Lord was with David, but he had left Saul. You know, so Saul is on his own here. The Lord is not helping him. And in fact, the Lord is at every turn frustrating his plans, right? How many Proverbs in the Psalms, you know, you have that repetition on how much the Lord delights catching the wicked in their own traps. You know, the wicked man digs a pit to ensnare his neighbor and then he falls right into it. Right? Yeah. So here the Lord, right, he's moving to just completely take the sauce out of Saul, right? He just can't get anything done at every turn. Yeah, it's so cool to see those things. Anybody else, any questions or comments on any of that?
The funny thing is, he was there 40 years as king.
Yeah, yeah. So this is a...
anybody lived.
Yeah. It's in the first of next year, I'm going to have a chronology for y'all. I'm working on it right now. I was hoping to have it today, but there's no way. There's just so much I got to figure out still. But, you know, as I was looking at all this, this era that we're in with Saul and David, when he begins to pursue him, this probably takes 10 years that Saul is chasing him through the 10 years that he's pursuing him and whatnot, you know? And that probably comes maybe 10 years after he becomes king. But, you know, but the point is, he's got a lot of time to figure out what's up and what's down, and yet he doesn't learn from any of his lessons. You know? Yeah, absolutely. All right, chapter 24. Again, just some big picture overview, what's going on here, because I know y'all have read this, and this is one of the more famous stories. This is where David spares Saul for the first time, top of page 39. And so what happens... Saul, again, finds out after he finishes with the raid of the Philistines. Saul finds out David is hiding in the wilderness of En-Gedi. And so Saul takes 3,000 chosen men out of Israel, and he goes down to pursue David. And he comes down to a cave, and he has to go in to relieve himself. But it just so happens that that's where David and some of his men are hiding out, at the back of the cave. Boy, howdy, this is a difficult situation. Look at verse 4. Look at 24:4, because this is interesting detail. Verse 4, it says, "Now the men of David said to him, 'Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you.'" Okay? Now, we don't have any record of any prophecy like that before this, before them saying that to David, right? And it seems like the implication of that is that David can kill Saul if he wants to, right? There's one or two ways that you can take what's going on there, and I've got this in your notes on page 39 for 24:4. Again, there's no other mention of this prophecy. This could have been a false prophecy that was made, or it could be one that's misapplied to Saul, because clearly David doesn't take it this way, right? David doesn't believe that it's in his hand to kill Saul. But it could be that the Lord is saying, look, I'll give your enemy into your hand, and you can do what seems good to you. The Lord will often test people that way, right? Okay, let's see what happens when I give Saul over to you, right? David, what are you going to do? And of course, the story answers that question. Verse 4, David arose stealthily and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Verse 5, and afterwards, David's heart struck him because he had cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Look at that. He gets all bent out of shape about that. What in the world? There's a long note about that on page 39, right in the middle of the page. That is not an insignificant thing, because for David to take a part of Saul's royal robe symbolically points to a transfer of power from the house of Saul to the house of David. But also, by him maiming Saul's robe that way, that made Saul out of touch, out of compliance with Torah requirements. And I've got the references to that in the quote there, both Numbers and Deuteronomy. So this symbol of Saul's kingship is unwearable. And David had, in a sense, symbolically invalidated Saul's claim to kingship, right? So it's not a minor thing that he did here. And
Samuel did that too.
Pardon?
Samuel.
Well, Saul did that to Samuel, right? When Saul... Saul grabbed Samuel's robe and tore it, right? Yeah, and then that's when Samuel said, just as you've torn my robe, so the Lord has torn the kingdom, away from you. But here, look at verse 6. You see exactly what David's thinking. He said to his men, the Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's, the Lord Yahweh's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed. So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. Right? So here David has opportunity to kill Saul, but in his faithfulness, David realizes it's not his prerogative to kill the Lord's anointed, the anointed king. Yeah.
Did David know the significance of cutting the corner off of Saul?
Possibly. Yeah. The fact that it says afterward, David's heart struck him, one of the possibilities is David goes in to do this because we know what he's going to do. He's going to take this robe and show, hey, I had a chance. But then after he does it, it may be that the significance of it hits him. You're like, oh, maybe I acted too quick on that, Or it could be that he didn't know the full significance of it, or didn't have it in his mind. But clearly, he takes that as something he ought not to have done, right? Because his heart strikes him on it, right? It's which probably is a Hebrew way of saying his conscience got him. So again, if you were in this situation, this pressure and the stress, okay, I'm going to get a memento to show him. I had the opportunity to kill you. But then after you do it, you think, oh, no, what have I done? All of us have done things like that. So it could be that. But whatever the case, we know that David, it really strikes his conscience, right? Oh, man, I shouldn't have done that. But nevertheless, you all know the story. Saul comes up out of the cave, and David calls out to him, my lord, the king. And David addresses him. Really interesting, two times. Verse 9, David says to Saul, why do you listen to the words of men who say, behold, David seeks your harm? David, in a sense, giving Saul the benefit of the doubt. Well, maybe there's some men that are telling you things that aren't true, right, about me, that I'm trying to kill you, that I'm trying to lie in wait. As Saul had said earlier, conspiring to try to kill him. But David says, look, I had the opportunity to kill you in the cave today, but I didn't because it's not for me to put up my hand against the Lord and his anointed. He says that at the end of verse 10. And he says, I love this. 11, he says, see my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. Saul addresses David as father, right? He gives Saul the benefit of the doubt. He treats him with great respect. He says, by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and I didn't kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. So let the Lord, verse 12, this is important. May the Lord judge between me and you, and may the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, and my hand shall not be against you. No, David believes that if he took Saul's life, that would be evil. That would be wickedness, right? Twistedness. One of the ultimate forms of sin, a crafty, conniving wickedness. And so he goes on, verse 14, whom is the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog? After a flea? I've got a note about that at bottom of page 39. That David says that in poetic form in Hebrew. Because we know he's been writing poems, right? We're going to find out a lot of his psalms are inspired by these events. We're going to look at some of those next year when we come back. And then as soon as he finishes, Saul calls out to David, verse 16. Notice how he addresses David. Is this your voice, my son, David? David calls him my father. Saul calls him my son, David. And Saul lifted up his voice and he wept. He said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil." Now take note of that. Saul knows exactly what he's doing. He knows that his pursuit of David is evil. You see that? It's wrong. It's not the right thing for him to do. And so he says, "Listen, I know you've dealt kindly with me. It would have been in your right if a man finds his enemy to kill me and go ahead. But that's not what you've done with me." So look at verse 20. He says, "And so now, behold, I know that you shall surely be king and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand." See that? He knows. Without a doubt. Verse 21, 22. "Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord Yahweh, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house." And David swore this to Saul. And Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold. So this is a really important chapter. At the top of page 39, in your notes, I've said this earlier, but this section that we're in, starting 24, 25, 26, part of what this larger section is meant to do is to give the evidence for David's faithfulness and his righteousness. Even given the opportunity to do something which technically, you know, given the customs of the day, he could have done. Killing the king who's pursuing his life, killing his enemy, right? He doesn't do it. He goes to a higher standard. And part of the reason for that is that later we know, and again, I've mentioned this earlier, but one of the references to this is in 2 Samuel 16:8, and we'll get to that next year. 2 Samuel 16:8, Shammai charges David with the blood guilt of Saul's house, implying that he had usurped the kingdom. These chapters serve to show that this is not true. Right? One of the controversies that happens in Israel's history, because not everybody has the full story, right? You know, back then they hear about Saul chasing David and they get on Twitter and Facebook and there's all these made up stories that are not true, right? Well, you know, David, oh man alive, you know, he's been lying and he's like a snake. He's just been lying in wait to kill Saul and take him so he can become king. We don't even know if he has the right to become king, right? So there are these rumors going around. And a couple of people, Shammai, accuse him that the blood guilt of Saul's house being destroyed is on David because he's usurped the kingdom. So these stories, these narratives that we're in, 24, 25, 26, establishes that's not what David did at all. He had two chances to kill Saul and just... take over, right? Insurrection. But he doesn't. He waits to let the Lord do his work. And so really, really important theologically for the larger picture of what's going on in 1 and 2 Samuel. Anybody, questions or comments on any of that before we look at these last couple of chapters here that we're going to look at?
Amazing. He had some sort of lucid motive.
Yeah.
He's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
We got evil spirits from the Lord messing with him.
We got, yeah, he's in bad shape.
Really,
yeah.
All of a sudden,
yeah,
it's just brilliant.
Right, yeah.
He sees everything, you know?
Yeah.
You're going to be king.
I want to be real careful what I say, but I've known a lot of crazy people. And there's often little glimpses of brilliance, right? There's that old saying, even a blind squirrel finds a nut every so often, right? So yeah, so there's these little pop-ups of clarity, you know, a good friend of mine said this years ago. He says it's not being out of touch with reality that makes you crazy; it's not being able to accept reality that makes you crazy.
No.
Right? That's what Saul's doing. He can't accept the reality of what the Lord has laid out, and that's driving him to be nuts. You know, jealousy, anger, rage, and all. Yeah. It's really fascinating. You know, you think he learns by now, but he doesn't. Chapter 25. Now, y'all, again, this is one of the more famous stories in the book. And I'm not going to go through every detail. I'm just going to give you the big picture. It starts off in just such an odd way to me. Look at 25:1. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. And that's it. That's all we get. Like, man, I was expecting a last speech or, you know, something. And it's just like they're like, oh, yeah, don't forget to tell everybody that Samuel died, right? And so that's just stuck at the beginning of this narrative. But it does kind of hinge us into the latter part of 1 Samuel here, these last several chapters. From the middle of chapter 25, verse 1 on, you get the story of David, Abigail, Nabal, that y'all probably know, right? Nabal. Let's just talk about the notes on this on page 40. You get Nabal. David, if you read the chapter, David and his men have been in the vicinity where Nabal, who is very rich, he has a bunch of livestock. And David and his men have been in that area, and they've been protecting Nabal's flocks, right? And so they send for Nabal, and they say, hey, we need some help. We need some food and some provisions. Will you help us? And Nabal says, absolutely not. And David says, okay, that's fine. Boys, saddle up. We're going to go up there and kill him. We're going to take what we want. Top of page 40, Nabal in Hebrew means fool. I don't think his mama gave him that name. That seems to, I mean, you know, if you name somebody fool from the beginning, you're kind of setting them up for disaster, right? So this is probably something that he acquired as he got older. He is described as a hard, evil man, 25:3. He is a worthless man who no one can reason with, 25:17. So he's a fool in every sense of the word. He's the prototypical fool that Proverbs describes. A worthless man that no one can reason with. We got a lot of those kind of people around too, right? You can't do anything with them. But he's also a Calebite, which means that he's one of David's close kinsmen. And so there should be some family connection there. But he refuses to help David. And he says, who is this David? Man, I hear all kind of people breaking away from their masters and go, am I going to take my bread and give my stuff to him? And again, David, after Nabal rejects him, David and his men had every right to go up. Well, not really, but they're taking it in their hands. They're going to up and kill him and take things under control. But Abigail, his wife, comes up and she hears what Nabal has done. And she says, oh, Lord, he's done it again. So she makes some fig cakes and loads up the donkeys, wine, 200 loaves of bread, right? Grain, raisins, fig cakes. She puts them on the donkey. She goes up. And starting in verse 19, you have her off and on. She gives the longest recorded speech from a woman in the Old Testament. So this is not insignificant, right? And it's just a great place to see how she persuades David to not kill Nabal, instead to forgive him and let me stand in his place, right? And she even does this play on words in verse 29. She says, if men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living, in the care of the Lord your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. Right? Just a little subtle touch back to David killing Goliath with a sling. Right? In other words, David, I know who you are. Right? 30, and when the Lord has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause for my Lord working salvation himself. And when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servants. In other words, David, don't do this thing. It's not in your hand to do it, right? Don't. You're going to be guilty. If you do this, and she's right, because even though Nabal is withheld paying for David's services, technically, in the middle of page 40, I've got a note that in the Torah, you were not to take that, you as an individual, were not to avenge that in cases that are wrong like this. Instead, you'd let the Lord deal with it in his own way. So David would have been usurping the authority of the Lord, taking vengeance here. And so Abigail, who's a righteous woman, she persuades him not to do it. And so she keeps David from sin. And At the end, y'all know the way the story ends. At the end, Abigail intercedes. They go back. Nabal finds out about it. He loses his mind. The Lord strikes him. It says in verse 37, his heart died within him. And about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal and he died. So he either has something like a stroke or something where he just goes, he's out. And then 10 days, he like goes into a coma. And then 10 days later, the Lord strikes him and he dies, which is exactly what the Lord says he does in the Torah to things like that. When somebody acts unjustly, right? Leave room for the vengeance of God, right? That type of thing going on. So there it says that in verse 39, the Lord has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head. And so David speaks to Abigail, and of course Abigail's a lovely woman. He takes Abigail as one of his wives. And so you have a record 43, 44 of David's other wives. He also took Ahinoam of Jezreel. Both of them became his wives. Saul had given him Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish. So David has been on the run, and Saul has given Michal to somebody else. Because David has not gone back to her ever since he's fled from Saul when he jumped out the window and ran off and she hid from him. So good place for us to stop right at time. Now, chapter 26, that's just the other example of David sparing Saul's life. And again, it's almost a repeat of what we just read, but this time, Saul is encamped, and David and one of his servants, they go down into Saul's camp, and David comes out with his spear and a jug of water that was at Saul's head, and then they go outside the camp, and they yell, "Hey!" And Abner, who is one of the generals of the army, he should have been watching over Saul, and David says, "What kind of guard are you? We've walked right in there, and looky here, I've got Saul's spear, and I've got his water. We could have killed all of y'all, right? But it's not for me to raise my hand against the Lord's anointed." And so, again, Saul recognizes David's voice, and he says, I've been wrong again. Verse 21, Saul says, "Listen, I've sinned. Return, my son David, for I will no more do you harm, because my life was precious in your eyes this day." David's thinking, "I've heard that before," right? For sure, yeah. And instead, David doesn't go back over to Saul. He says, "Hey, you send your servant over, and I'll give you your spear and your water jug back, but we're just going to leave it there." And as he leaves, Saul says to David, "Blessed be you, my son David. You will do many things and will succeed in them." So David went his way, and Saul returned to his place. That's the last recorded conversation we have between Saul and David. It's all downhill from here. Next year, when we come back, y'all read, start chapter 27, read on through the end of 1 Samuel. We'll start there the first week, and then we'll be in 2 Samuel from there on out. Now, spoiler alert, I'm sure y'all have read it, but, you know, we're in the last chapters. Saul is just going to spin further and further out of control, and by the end of 1 Samuel, he's going to be killed, both he and Jonathan. And then that moves us into 2 Samuel, with David lamenting their death. And all the things that happened in the aftermath of that. So, yeah, doing good. We're right on time to be able to finish up next year, so, which is incredible. Usually, this is the time of the year where I've been telling everybody, "Oh, yeah, we're going to get through here." And in my mind, I'm thinking, there's no way we're going to make it. I don't know how we're going to make it. I don't know what we're going to do. But we're in a good place to be able to finish up because 2 Samuel is a little bit shorter than 1 Samuel. All right, y'all, any questions or comments on any of that before we close up?
Should have read through what?
Through the end of 1 Samuel. Yeah, from what, chapter 26 through the end of 1 Samuel. Is that right? Is that what I'm telling y'all? Yeah. No. I'm sorry. Chapter 27. Chapter 27 through the end of 1 Samuel. Yeah. And I'm going to write a note so I can remember that myself. Anybody else? Any questions or comments on any of that? All right, y'all. Well, let me close us out. Hope everybody has a happy Thanksgiving, joyous Christmas, Merry New Year, right? So I won't see y'all again until after that. But I hope y'all have a good holiday break, and we'll see y'all in January. Let me pray for us, and we will turn loose. Father, again, we thank you for the opportunity we have to study your word together. And we thank you for your goodness and your mercy that is constantly displayed to us and for us. And particularly now that we know so much more than David and Samuel and Saul and all the men that we're reading about here, and the women even, as righteous and as faithful as they were, you've revealed so much more since their days. And so we thank you for where we live in the current times, even though we are in a dark and twisted culture. Nevertheless, we have hope, and we can know what is pleasing to you and what's good to you in all things, because you have clearly revealed these things to us. And so we give you all thanks, all praise for Jesus' great name's sake. Amen.